The Gary Knoll Show, daily at noon on the Progressive Radio Network.
Live from New York City, it's The Gary Knoll Show. And now, your host, Gary Knoll.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll, and I'd like to welcome you to this program. Today, we have a lot to cover. I will not be able to take calls because of commentaries and guests and information. The latest on why they're letting criminals out of jail in the Netherlands, I'll talk about that. Spinning the U.S. failure in Iraq, President Obama will be giving an address tonight about the end of combat operations in Iraq. If or only it were true, it isn't, and I'll give you the counterpoint. Commentaries today on genetically manipulated crops by FWM Indahl. Also my guest, Scott Tipps, talking more about why we should say no to Senate Bill 510, the food safety bill, and why, unfortunately, many people in the media are supporting the bill without looking at how it impacts our freedom of choice and the real politics behind this bill to make everyone eating genetically engineered crops. Time permitting, commentary from Professor Jim Quinn from Op-Ed News on the Age of Mammon, also the economic black hole that we're going into now that we're not being told the truth about. We'll tell you the truth about what's happening, what you can expect. And this is a part of the commentary I'm hopeful to get on because you need to hear it. If for some reason I cannot get all this on, I have a 3 o'clock show today with guests, and I'll get it on at that time. And that's from Global Research, the economic collapse, which is coming. As you can see, a full show. Let's go right to the latest on health and healing. Many people in the audience know two things. One, I've never done any drugs or alcohol or smoked in my life. I do not moralize about it. I don't have the right to, nor would I. I believe that freedom of choice dictates a person's selections. If I choose to eat tofu and they choose to eat hamburger, that's their right. They do not become any less of a friend, nor do I believe in moralizing. But I do believe that we're at a point where we have to be just practical. This whole idea of criminalizing drug possession or drug use to me makes no sense. I'll be doing a full 2-hour special on this topic of why we just don't decriminalize it and provide in every community in America health support, sociologists, psychologists, behavioralists, physicians to help people who want to get off, whether it's methamphetamine, crack cocaine, and also show them why have you selected this to begin with, and what are your options, what other ways can you deal with the issues in your life that you're wanting to escape. But here's a case in point. Also, we're going broke in many states because of the privatizing of prisons where they make profits when we continue to send people to jail. The Netherlands. They're closing prisons. That's correct. So for all the prohibitionists, including our own Drug Enforcement Administration, who have claimed repeatedly in the Christian right and the whole group on the right that we should not be tolerant of marijuana policies or any kind of drug policies, and if you start one, it goes to another, and yet these same hypocrites will drink alcohol or smoke cigarettes or drink coffee, all of which have the capacity to create addictive behavior in individuals by adversely affecting different receptor sites in the brain. And yet, they have their drugs of choice, which they've chosen to legalize. I believe all this stuff should be legal. Then education, so at least you know what are the likely outcomes of the choices you're going to make. Also, look what we would do to ending crime. Why are they closing the prisons in the Netherlands? Because they don't have enough criminals. You heard me right. Let's just compare the Netherlands to California. With a population of 16.6 million, the Dutch prison population is just barely reaching 12,000 in the entire country out of almost 17 million. California is a little more than twice the size of the Netherlands in population. And yet, California's actual prison population is 171,000. 171,000. Realistically, it should be about 26,000 if you compared it to the Netherlands. No, it's 171,000. So, whose drug policies are keeping the streets safer? The Netherlands, where it's legal, or in California? Just something to pay attention to once we can get beyond our dogma. Something that I'm working on now, I'm not anywhere near, and I'm glad that at least you're able to hear me on this broadcast, but fortunately I have a very good, high-quality, portable broadcast unit I can take anywhere. And I'm filming several films as we speak. One of them is a new, completely brand new feature film on the drugging of our children. The first drugging of our children was well accepted and well watched. In fact, millions upon millions of people watched the film. This one's all about pathologizing our children as an income stream. Adding to that pathologizing is Pamela Paul, the New York Times Magazine. Here's what she has to say. And this is why we should be very careful. Preschool depression is becoming increasingly common, writes Pamela Paul in the New York Times Magazine. But you can stop it in its tracks with good medications and treatment. It's called now, get this, preschool depression. And it will likely join parents, quote, what to worry about, lexicon alongside ED, ADD, and ADHD and other disorders unheard of 30 years ago. So says this in-depth New York Magazine investigation, New York Times Magazine investigation. Though many experts maintain that toddlers are too psychologically immature to experience depression, a growing number of child psychologists, psychiatrists believe it can hit children as young as 2 and 3, and that treating the condition immediately, there's Hillary Clinton, can rewire the brain in a way that diminishes the problem later on. Now, here are the 5 signs to look for to make sure your kid gets into that very expensive psychological treatment as quickly as possible. 1, the inability to express and experience joy or pleasure. Many of the symptoms these young kids, quote, look a lot like those in older people. And so if they don't show a lot of joy and pleasure, then clearly that's a big red flag. Secondly, morbid play. Another adult depression symptom that gets downsized in toddlers is suicidal ideation. Instead of considering killing themselves, toddlers may orchestrate scenarios around violence. 3, frustrated outbursts that stem from sadness. Wow. We've never heard that before in human history, have we? Kids that actually are frustrated and throw little temper tantrums, clearly they need electroconvulsive therapy, lobotomy, or the drugs that the New York Times Magazine and its editors and its publisher would love to see your kid take. Oh, my goodness. Quote, misery and abject sadness. Well, okay. And then anxiety. Uh-oh, this is a, quote, biological marker. Ooh, they must have studies showing brain chemical imbalances, if it's biological, of childhood depression that raise stress hormones, cortisol. Is that the same stress hormone, cortisol, that is a normal part of all anxiety? That no matter what you're anxious about, let's say going out shopping or getting a new toy, we'll raise it. Yeah, same one. But now, according to Duke University psychiatrist, oh yeah, biological marker. And finally, another behavioral disorder. So in other words, if your kid might have a little agitation or be a little hyper, clearly then that means they're depressed and they need medical treatment. Well, let's just go through these real quick. First and foremost, there is no such thing as a biological marker for depression. It's never been identified. It doesn't exist. It's fraud. Secondly, most of ADD and ADHD are frauds. In fact, almost every single kid that I've worked with, whose parents have brought them in, they can be cleaned up in their diet, meaning you take out the sugar and the artificial sweetener and the caffeine and gee whiz, the kid actually can pay attention. And then, oh, did we forget there are some teachers that just don't like the way some kids act. And so, therefore, the quickest way of dealing with a kid you don't like is get them diagnosed and then get them drugged. Well, and then there are kids who don't like some classes. Interesting, I counseled a parent with a child and ADD and on Ritalin. So I asked him, Bob, are there any teachers you like? Oh, yeah. And do you like what they teach? Yeah. And how they teach? Yeah. And do you learn? Yeah. Do you read the textbooks? Do you do the test? Yeah. Are you focused? Yeah. But then there are teachers you don't like or don't like how they teach? Or no. And you don't pay attention? No. You wander, your mind wanders, you look out the window? Yeah. Gee, it reminds me of myself. So it had nothing to do. And with ADD, it had to do with just what we put our attention to. And then frustrated outbursts, well, gee whiz, I guess that's everybody on the planet. But then again, that's good news for the drug industry. Let's drug everybody and let God figure it out. And then morbid play. I guess if you ever had any thought of violence, then you are suffering from undiagnosed depression. Well, then, once again, that's everybody on the planet. And then the inability to experience constant joy or pleasure. Well, how about everybody that's ever lived, including the Buddha and Christ and Confucius and Martin Luther King and Gandhi? My goodness, look how uneventful and insignificant their lives were because they suffered from a lack of joy and pleasure. If only we had more Pamela Pauls of the New York Times Magazine telling us that we got to get our kids diagnosed and get them in treatment immediately with those good drugs. Jesus, man. Oh, wow. Where have we sunk if you're in the New York Times not low enough to get anyone to pay attention to you? Red meat, again linked to cancer. Last week I talked about the dangers of red meat. Oh, by the way, where do you see the confrontations in my new films where I go after these journalists for hire and I go after these psychologists who think they actually have a brain and psychiatrists after we have someone in their office who's completely normal but then is diagnosed with a different psychiatric disorder by every single psychiatrist they see and given different medications. And then we go out back at... Well, I won't go into any further. A lot of people just were completely disconnected. Oh, so this was a normal person? Yeah, and you diagnose them and you put them on these medications. The side effects of these medications are suicidal ideation or suicide. Well, you know, mistakes can happen. How many other times do they happen? Anyhow, you'll see it in the new feature film. Increase intakes of red meat can increase the risk of prostate cancer, with the meat's heme iron content one of the possible culprits. This is published in the American Journal of Epidemiology, and this is from the National Cancer Institute. In fact, if you eat red meat, men, listen up, you increase your risk no matter what meat you eat, and no matter what quantity, and no matter how much fat, you increase your risk of prostate cancer by 12%. Furthermore, red meat can increase your risk of advanced prostate cancer by 30%. So that's not the only study. There's lots of other studies showing through the National Cancer Institute, high intakes of meat and red meat, processed meat, can increase your risk of lung and colorectal cancer by up to 20%. So let's pay attention to some of this. One more reason to go vegan. And finally, few Americans realize that heart disease risk starts in childhood. Now, almost all diseases start in childhood. But a new study found that while many Americans are concerned about heart disease, almost two-thirds mistakenly believe that heart disease risk only starts when you're older. Heart disease is the number one cause of death right now. Cancer's quickly approaching it. 92% of all Americans right now listening to this radio program are at risk of heart disease. That's according to the Preventive Cardiovascular Nurses Association and a major study and a lot of reasons to believe that we're not learning anything, except for about the 5 to 7% of Americans who are proactive each day and do good things for their health and therefore are not at risk. Everyone else, you're at risk. So pay attention, it starts young and gets worse. I'm Gary Knoll. We're here to talk about issues that make a difference in our lives. Back in a moment to take on commentaries and questions. Please stay with us.
Hey, what's up, man? Hey,
brother, what's up?
Hey, how you
recorded, man.
Yeah, brother, like,
dig it.
Stop.
There's far too many of you dying. You know we've got to find a way to bring some loving here today. Yeah. Father, Father, we don't need to escalate. You see, war is not the answer, for only love.
Welcome, all of you. Evidently, because of where I'm at, I was offline for a few moments. I'm back online now. My guest at 3 o'clock today will be Mike Whitney, and he's a finance scholar, a journalist specializing in the domestic economics. And we're going to talk about the backward slide into recession and what's happening, what's going to happen, how bad's it going to get, and what we can do about it, the good news after the bad news. That's coming at you. I'm going to have a commentary in just a moment. Spinning the U.S. failure in Iraq, Robert Perry from Op-Ed News, to counterbalance some of the information given by Barack Obama today, this evening, about our ending combat mission in Iraq. Let me just mention real quick that for those of you who have been on vacation or out of town, I have a brand new set of products that completely revolutionize the older products, and including green stuff and greens and grains, more to come next week. But for this week, be aware that you're getting more actual products, so it's more servings. That's a big plus. That you're getting all the power of fresh vegetables and whole foods in one container. It's Circle K Kosher. And it's a phenomenal input into the body of a living food. It's raw food. And I didn't have this before, but I have 10,000 ORAC antioxidant measurements per serving. Every time you put a teaspoon, you're getting 10,000 of that. Before I had zero. You're getting 500 gram size. You're getting zero fat and zero cholesterol and a small amount of calories. The green stuff blend is made of the organic barley grass juice powder and the organic spirulina and the chlorella and celery, new things. Celery, collard greens, broccoli, sprouts, onion, kale, spinach, cauliflower, cabbage, oat beta-glucan, arugula, asparagus, and radish. You're talking about the most powerful, all-inclusive, cruciferous vegetable combination in the world that I know of. And they're all here. It took me over a year and a half to make this product as best as it can be. This is called the greens and grains. Nothing in greens and grains is in green stuff, and nothing in green stuff is in greens and grains. All new formulas. But just imagine now, and I've changed the flavor. Why? Because I wanted a flavor that children and finicky consumers, oh, I don't like the taste of all those vegetables. Well, now they will. because I blended, and it took about 50 tests to blend so everybody loves the flavor. I blended natural pineapple and natural cherry together, and it's just delicious. Delicious. So you're getting all the new stuff in the greens and grains, and then the green stuff. The green stuff, the green stuff, those were the ingredients I just mentioned. And so the green stuff is new. The greens and grains are new. So you got all new greens and grains and green stuff. So that's what you got. Okay. And the number that you can call in to get your green stuff and greens and grains, and understand what I did. I'm giving you more of everything, giving you better of everything, giving you higher quality of everything, giving you more organic of everything, giving you raw, kosher, and fresh as can be, even a new manufacturer. So that's what it is. But I did not raise my price $35 that I should have because of the economic problems people are having. I kept the price low. But you're not going to be able to get buy one, get one free on this. There's no way I could do that. It would be physically impossible for me. So just understand that you're getting the best of the best in green stuff, the best in greens and grains, the two together, which I use every morning, and then throughout the day are phenomenal. And we have a whole bunch of information in our office. When you call Jessica or Diane or Sean or Mila, they'll give you all the information you want. Call 877-627-5065, 877-627-5065. And real quick, we got Lou Ann Panessi on the phone. And before we go to Carol Lee in studio and my commentary, then on to my guest, Scott Tipps, talk about why we should oppose the Senate Bill 510, the food safety bill. Let's say hello to Lou Ann Panessi. Hi, Lou Ann.
Hey, Gary, how are you?
Doing great.
I have two quick things. One is an announcement. I just want to remind all of the people from our Saturday health support group that we're not going to be meeting this Saturday because of Labor Day weekend. And we do encourage people to have fun, so a lot of the class is going to be out having some fun. So the following weekend, which is September 11th, Saturday the 11th, that's when we're going to have our next Saturday meeting. And again, we'll be talking about holistic dentistry. The second thing I wanted to mention was that I'm getting an awful lot of emails from people in the audience, either patients or people who've known me, very, very curious about this whole concept of homesteading. And the most common questions are, where do we do homesteading? How exactly do we do it? But I tell you, you're waking up a lot of people, Gary, with these shows. And so it's nice to see that people are so interested in the homesteading. So I wonder if you could just comment on that for us.
Be happy to. By the way, a lot of people have evidently been contacting us about downloading Sunday Night Show. It was a zinger. I mean, it was one of those that you just knock it out of the park. We don't have it. I wished we did. But we lost the show. An engineer. We have a new engineer on Sunday night, and he did not know how to transfer it over, so it's gone. However, I will redo comments. It was a commentary for a better part of the show. And I will do it again later on this week. I think people are simply waking up because it's time to wake up and realize that we cannot continue living a life without concern, not a anxiety concern, but a conscious concern. Is this sustainable? Is this healthy? Is this right? And is it not time to take the next step in our life? I'm a big believer, Lou Ann, as you and many people in the health support groups know, that there comes a time when we must honor our rites of passage. We have to stop seeking the right passage and evolve into the right person in the passage that we're in. And I believe that we shouldn't try to seek out some comfortable little niche somewhere and just be secure. Because in the desire to be secure, we frequently we start to see our bodies age prematurely because we're too comfortable to really push ourselves. We don't change our diet because we're comfortable with our comfort foods. We don't question the nature of our friendships or relationships because we're too comfortable, even if they're not what we ideally would want. Well, it's comfortable. And therefore, we're not in a passage. We're stuck in a passage we should be in. We're stuck in a passage that is dark and no longer provides us with vitality or insight or clarity. There's, in other words, you wake up each day when you're in the wrong passage, and when you should have been out of that passage. You should be preparing for the next stage of your life in a constructive way, and there are no great certainties with any new passage. You start, in effect, as a neophyte. You start and say, okay, I'm on a learning curve, and I'm at the bottom of it. What do I got to do to learn? And the rich and powerful that I counsel, and just last week before I left on this long trip, there were two men. Together they have over $1 billion. Neither one, after 3 hours of counseling, were willing to make any changes in their life at all. As one said, so I live another 5 years. I said, you're being optimistic. You know, how do you know you're going to live 5 years? You've got diabetes, you're overweight, you've got all these other conditions. How do you know? Well, I figure I got 5 years, and if as long as I can keep doing things I like doing, that's enough. So you die at 60, and that's enough? What about your family or things you enjoy? Well, they're all taken care of. Oh, as if money is all that's necessary. That's the mindset of so many rich people, because they don't want to go through discomfort, because they feel that they already earned their right to be comfortable because they were smart enough to make their money or worked hard enough. I'm not questioning how they made their money. I'm simply saying that when money or the comfort that it brings you and the security that it brings you, then you don't realize that almost everything in life is impermanent. Everything. And everything that you've ever had, you're going to lose. It's just when. So why not start a new journey to learn the next stage of life so that you can re-engage and be excited and creative? Because the solutions to all of our problems today, whether it's poverty or war or suffering or racism or sexism or bigotry, all of the answers lie in a journey of discovering authentic truths. And we're not there. We're in our comfort zone. We want the right person to come and lead us. We want the right information on television. So we stay passively tuned and connected and don't realize everything is passing us by. So we have to surrender our comfort in order to grow. You can't have both. And yet we'd like to think that we can have both. How familiar are you with the Buddha?
Only somewhat.
Siddhartha. He was born into royalty. And he was supposed to be a king and unite the 16 separate states of... at that time, he was actually born in what is Nepal, not in southern India, it's northeastern part of India. But his father made sure that at no time did this young boy ever suffer or feel pain. And instead, he could see nothing that was bad. He was pampered. He was not allowed to see other people who did suffer. So everything around him was to be orchestrated and choreographed to show that everything, the food was always perfect, it was perfectly presented, the music, the women. And at a young age of 16, he married his cousin, and they lived in pleasure, and he had a son. But on his 29th year of life, he decides to take a journey, and that's where his four truths emerged. He left the palace against his father's wishes, and he went out on these journeys, and there he encountered life as he had never seen it before. He encountered the fact that one of the first rules change, that you get older, and then sickness, that life is connected to death, and therefore it's inevitable, that death is there, which is finite, and that introspection through meditation allows you to better understand how to deal with this suffering. Hence, through suffering and loss, we begin our authentic journey. And we are not in a place today that we're willing to engage in authentic change. Instead, we want to live as the Vedic early Hindu rituals did, that everything is in the ritual, but you don't have to change. But if we don't change, then we can't rejuvenate ourselves. We can't reinvent ourselves. We cannot expand ourselves. Real truth does not follow from ritual. Inner discipline of the mind opens the door for transcendence. And therefore you can transcend your pain. Not that you can dismiss it or deny it, but you can understand it. Much like Martin Luther, who engaged in pain to such extreme he nearly killed himself, so did also the Buddha. He too joined five other ascetics through physical suffering, and they would go a long period of time through punishing themselves. In effect, he tried to die. And through his efforts of trying to die, when he didn't die, he was reborn. And this lasted for about 6 years. And a young girl offered the Buddha a bowl of rice. And he then realized the interconnection of life. Here's rice, here's a young girl, and he has got something to eat. The other ascetics around him, by the way, were angry at him, called him all kinds of names and wanted nothing to do with him. But that's the changing of his life. When he could not punish himself anymore and try to find the answers to his questions, which had evaded him through all of his suffering, through all of his starvation, eating one grain of rice a day, and sitting in the same position for days on end, and being just a little tiny skeleton of a person, he couldn't find it. And this whole idea that we grow by suffering is nonsense, that because we suffer we're a better person is nonsense. That we have, by all the rituals that we, our prayer books and everything else, by repeating the prayers and the rituals over and over ad nauseum, we're a better person. Nonsense. No, all this is just a part of the control of the ritual of life. Change is life. And do we accept change and flow with it? Or do we try to hide from change? Do we try to deny change? Are we angry at change? And this shows our duality. And in our duality, we cannot awaken. Hence, there is no nirvana. Nirvana comes from the awakening and the enlightenment from that. So you become one with the world in which you live. The moment is the reality. And through that reality is compassion. And compassion is essential to enlightenment. Hence, you cannot see the suffering of others, no matter what their political persuasion or religion or economic caste or education. You must show compassion and love and understanding and healing to all. But you can't do that through individual rituals. And so we bring our Dharma. Now, the first lesson of setting into motion the wheel of the Dharma. We need balance. Balance means that you look at life and say, what do I need today to stay interconnected with all the things that are important in me allowing myself to be a part of life? Well, then you pay attention to the poor around you. You pay attention to the needs. You pay attention to what society needs. You pay attention that we shouldn't be in wars because there is no balance in wars. Wars create imbalance and suffering of all. You can justify it, rationalize it, but it doesn't change it. You can see that 12 million children go to bed hungry each day in the United States. But if you're in balance, you say, how can I be a glutton and eat more than I need and throw away what I do not consume when there are hungry people? I must show my compassion. I must show my interconnectedness to all life. It is not important what the person's economy is. It's important that I do not lessen my capacity to help or heal others through an artificial political dialogue. So that's why you've got to stop looking for the right, and you've got to live life in truth. And in truth, everything reveals itself. And therefore, you'll see the truth from the lie. And you've got to surrender the need to control everything in your life. And hence, you'll surrender your depression, your apathy. You'll surrender your anger and rage. You'll surrender these things, because you'll not see them constructive in the change you need. And stop thinking, I deserve. That's a selfish pursuit. My worth. All the things that we do to excess and then create imbalance. So when people are now looking at their life, some are seeing that their life has not lived in balance. And the balance they need for the future is not where they are now. So they should start a journey, start it reasonably, intelligently, start it with their eyes open, their heart open, their mind open, and therefore say, what is the future and how can I make it whole? How can I be self-sufficient? How can I be integrated with other people so I can share my knowledge and my gifts with them at the same time? And they're looking for homesteads. They're looking for the next step. And since we have a crash coming over the next 2 to 5 years, it'll get really bad in 2 years, but it'll be devastating in 5 years. And then the options won't be there. So the wise person's doing it now. So I'm going to be doing more lectures and discussions on this in the near future, but at least people are awakening to the idea of homesteading. It's not an easy process, by the way. The idea you're going to go out in the woods and throw down some seeds someplace on an abandoned farm and suddenly be self-sufficient, it's not going to happen. Most people would try that and fail. So you have to do something with reason, and hence balancing reason with inner wisdom, and then mastery. And mastering things, just mastering the art of tending to vegetables and tending to fruit. It's an art, and you have to master the discipline to do it. Otherwise, we get impatient. This isn't growing fast enough. You know, no, you can't get it to grow faster. You can simply tend it in its own time. So there's a lot to learn before people rush off and do something. So we'll discuss this more in depth on another occasion, Luann. All the best to you.
Thank you, Gary.
Okay. Now, a quick commentary, because I can see the clock, and I've got a commentary quick. And then my guest, Scott Tibbs, and on why we should oppose Senate Bill 510, and then Kara Lee to share some thoughts from people in the audience. From Robert Perry, op-ed, my own comment first. If the President of the United States says, you know, our military expedition in Iraq is over, our combat part of it's over, he will not be telling the truth. Here's what you should hold him to account for. The 100,000 private mercenary contractors who are going out and doing the search and seizures, the kills, the assassination groups, and are a very destabilizing part of that. They're considered American because we pay for them and they're under American control. The 50,000 troops left there, whose title will change, but they'll be doing the same identical thing. And the fact that we'll have over 94 military bases, some of the largest in the world, and still holding massive amounts of political prisoners, and still torturing and waterboarding at Bagram Air Force Base, and the largest embassy in the world, and all this with the control of the neocons behind them. Put that in perspective, and then I believe we could have the truth, but we won't have the truth tonight. We'll have propaganda. When I watched the last U.S. combat battalions leave Iraq 2 weeks ago, I couldn't help but recall the scene when the last Soviet troops departed Afghanistan on February 15, 1989. In both cases, the two governments soft-pedaled the hard truth about the strategic defeats that the withdrawals represented. Official Washington, in particular, has been eager to spin the Iraq withdrawal as a success, a prelude to a bright Iraq future in which the United States can begin to recoup the $1 to $3 trillion investment over the past 7 years, not to mention get something back for the 4,416 American soldiers who died during the adventure. But what do you get back from a dead American soldier? But the prospects for a long-term U.S. domination of Iraq appear dim. Once the 50,000 American military advisors are gone, scheduled to depart by the end of 2011, the U.S. will have to rely on an army of State Department security contractors to protect the network of diplomatic offices, including a giant embassy in Baghdad and consulates in Erbil, Kurdistan, and Basra in the south. Meanwhile, any residual U.S. military presence, however its package, remains unpopular within Iraqi society that has resented the bloody U.S. occupation that has left hundreds of thousands of Iraqis dead and millions injured, unemployed, sweltering in the heat, and homeless. For instance, supporters of radical Shiite cleric Muqtada al-Sadr have vowed to take up arms again if the U.S. withdrawal is not completed on schedule. In the Shiite holy city of Najaf, a 2-acre section of Martyrs Cemetery has been set aside for a renewed uprising if the U.S. forces remain after the withdrawal deadline. And this is according to Abu Muhammad, the Siemens cemetery supervisor. If the Americans leave, we don't think they will. We'll make it a burial site for our parents. Already 4,250 Sadr's fighters and supporters are buried in the cemetery, victims of violent clashes with occupation forces. The threat of a renewed uprising also is a reminder that Sadr's unilateral ceasefire in 2007 was the reason for the reduction in violence that had been ripping Iraq apart. Likewise, the Sunni militias, many of whom were bought off by U.S. payments to change sides starting in 2006, have also been showing their discontent on how the Iraqi government has been treating them. In recent weeks, Sunni militias, these very militants we have been paying money to and arming, have attacked with bombs, mortars, and rockets inside Baghdad. And as the violence again spikes up, Iraq's government remains deadlocked over how to apportion power after an inconclusive election last March. The likelihood that U.S.-favored officials can continue to protect American interests or even want to protect that interest goes dimmer. However, back in Washington, everything seems to have changed in a different way. They're all looking at the bright side. President Obama wants to continue the military drawdown without getting blamed for what history may record as a humiliating U.S. defeat. And the influential neocons want to pretend that their recommended surge in 2007 worked and that their original idea to invade in Iraq in 2003 was the right call. Republicans don't want to remind the voters about George W. Bush's weapons of mass destruction lies, and the major U.S. media hopes an aura of success in Iraq will obscure its own role in the debacle. It promoted the war. All American media promoted war. They were all wrong. Even among critics of the war, there seems to be more relief that the war is finally coming to an end than a willingness to comment on the American failure. There's also some suspicion on the left that the U.S. military occupation will simply continue under some new subterfuge. Yet, without hard-hitting assessments of the failure, official Washington gets yet another reprieve on any accountability. That's especially good news for the neocons who manipulated the U.S. political media process to get their war of choice in Iraq 7 years ago and have survived the war more deeply entrenched within Washington's policy and opinion circles than before. The neocons have paid little or no price for their stove-piped intelligence on Iraq's weapons of mass destruction, nor on the mythical cakewalk, nor on the premature mission accomplished celebrations, nor for the horrible death tolls, the maimed soldiers, and the damage done to America's image in the Middle East and around the world. They have paid not a twit of anything. Rather than being punished, neocon ideologues have advanced, spreading out from their traditional base within the think tanks like the American Enterprise Institute and the Center for Strategic and International Studies to take influential positions at more mainstream and even liberal bastions such as the Council on Foreign Relations, the Brookings Institute, and the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. The neocons are in power there. Neocon writers also have come to dominate key media platforms such as the Washington Post's op-ed page. Meanwhile, neocon critics like realist diplomat Chase Freeman and many ex-CIA analysts have been pushed further into the margins of Washington thought. They're given no forum. In large part, the neocons, the warmongers, consolidated their power despite all the false claims about Iraq's resulted from their success in defining the Iraqi war troop surge in 2007 as the key factor in reducing civil violence. Thus, they were able to extricate themselves from the Iraq war lies and turn the tables on the critics and surge doubters, including Barack Obama when he was the Democratic presidential candidate. When Obama argued that the reasons for the dip in violence were more complicated than simply the surge worked, he was hectored by media questionnaires, including CBS anchor Katie Couric and ABC's George Stephanopoulos, demanding to know why he wouldn't just admit that John McCain had been right about the surge. And finally, Obama chose to retreat in the face of this Washington conventional wisdom, regardless of how misguided it was. Finally, he admitted to Fox News' Bill O'Reilly that the surge, quote, succeeded beyond our wildest dreams. What in the world are you thinking? the surge and its accomplishments were a myth, a lie. Obama's cave-in then allowed the neocons and their sympathizers to further ridicule anyone who wouldn't go along. The reversal also was an early sign that Obama would rather finesse than fight over issues of fact, even an important question regarding national security. Still, many military analysts believe Bush's surge, about 30,000 U.S. troops, was at best a minor factor in improving Iraq's security climate. And Woodward... that's Woodward of Woodward and Bernstein, Bob Woodward, reported that Sunni rejection of al-Qaeda extremists in Anbar province, which preceded the surge, and the surprise decision of radical Shiite cleric al-Sadr in order to get his massive militia to cease fire were the important factors. That's what caused all that reduction. And also, with this vicious ethnic cleansing, they had succeeded in killing most of each other, meaning whoever was targeted was dead. Several million Iraqis were estimated to be refugees. They just left. And concrete walls were built between Sunni and Shiite areas and made death squad raids more difficult. And during the so-called surge, U.S. forces expanded a policy of rounding up so-called military-age males, meaning lock up tens of thousands of young boys in prison on no suspicions at all. And awesome U.S. firepower, you know, well, you put all that together and what do you have? So understand something. The neocons have rehabilitated themselves. Not surprisingly, they used their stronger position to push Obama into another surge for Afghanistan. And down the road, the neocons also have kept alive the possibility of even one more regime change, war with Iran. Significantly, too, the neocons have built powerful alliances within commanders. They have on their side General Petraeus. He is neocon. And then he sought the counsel of a really hyper-neocon on steroids, Max Boot, of the Council on Foreign Relations. And Petraeus was nervous about some mild criticism of Israel that had been included in his prepared testimony to the Senate Armed Service Committee. And as Petraeus hastened to stomp out any thought that he might actually be critical of Israel, heaven help anyone in our audience who's ever critical of the neocons in Israel, he emailed Boot about how this could be managed. And earlier, Petraeus had invited Boot and his fellow neocon think tankers, Frederick Kagan, to tour the Afghan war zone. Well, that's, you know, suddenly then it's all neocon. It's all surge that worked. Just more troops, boots on the ground, guns in the air, drones, bombs. Yeah, that's how we won. No, we didn't. We didn't win anything. This has been one massive catastrophe. And one day people actually wake up, get their minds together, and realize that we have inflicted extreme punishment on an awful lot of people with 1.5 million dead that didn't deserve to die. Depleted uranium has created a massive environmental catastrophe of unimaginable proportions. And watch how it's all spun tonight. I'm Gary Noll, back in a moment.
On the oceans and upon our seas, fish full of mercury.
Welcome all of you. I'm Gary Noll. Let's go immediately to my guest, Scott Tipps, for Newsmaker Update. Scott Tipps has been the general counsel for the National Health Federation, the world's oldest health freedom organization protecting our rights. And we are here today to talk about what's wrong with Senate Bill 510, especially since Democracy Now! And Amy Goodman are promoting it. And I'm saying she's wrong. The left is wrong. We need no Senate bill. We need no food safety bills that are new. This is just a red herring. This is a Trojan bill It will allow the genetic engineering companies like DuPont, Monsanto, to have more control over our food policies. Your thoughts, Scott Tipps.
Gary, you couldn't have said it better, and you are absolutely correct. And it just boggles my mind that someone like Amy Goodman would even support this monstrosity that's just going to mean more government in our lives and not more food safety or more health, but less health and less food safety. Anytime you get the federal government involved in something like this, you're just getting more government without accountability, and you're going to end up with less health, not more.
Now, tell us what's wrong with the Senate bill and why we should let our legislators know today no to Senate Bill 510.
Well, the main reason to oppose Senate Bill 510 is it will give into the hands of the Food and Drug Administration yet more arbitrary powers to go in and wreak havoc amongst small food producers. And that is exactly what we don't want. Just as a small example, they have the right to bill the inspected companies for their inspections. Under this act, Senate Bill 510, the bill, they will have the ability and the right to bill each and every inspected company for their re-inspections. And the problem with that is they can re-inspect as often as they want, and it's a big cash cow for the FDA. Oh, we need more money? Okay, let's just go in and re-inspect that little food producer that we don't like because they make organic whatever, and we will get them, put them out of business in a fat hurry because of this. And all we have to do is follow our new law and reinspect them. That's just one item, let alone the fact that they can cause a recall in a product just on the reasonable belief, and I say that in quotation marks, that any article of food is or will cause serious adverse health consequences. And it's just on a suspicion. It's not even on any solid evidence or even a reasonable evidence. It's a reasonable belief. And that could be based on anything. So there's absolutely no protection against abuses, and it won't correct the problems anyway. This is something that should be handled at the local and state levels. That's what it's meant to do. It's unconstitutional. There's no power for them to do this. And yet what we find with each of these bills that come out each time with the we find a further and further extension of federal government power over the individual and over the states, and a suppression of states' rights and individual rights. And that's all this is about. It's about more power in the hands of an already abusive central government and FDA.
Tell us what people can do now to contact your organization, because I know that you have some form letters that will be sent out in petitions, so it makes it a little easier people contact your organization. Could you tell us how to do that?
Yes, it's actually really easy, and thank you for asking, Gary, because what people would do is just go to www.thenhf.com and click on the button that says Government Affairs, and then there's a secondary button that says Federal. And right there near the top is a chart, and you just scan down to the Food Safety Act Senate Bill, or S-510, parenthesis H.R. 2749. There's a sample letter that you can print out and send in to your congressman, your congresswoman, in this case to your senator, because these are things that still have to be hashed over with the House bill, but this is something that needs to be sent in right away. We also have a lobbyist who is acting on our behalf and has already made some intervention.
We're going to say goodbye to our WMYE audience. Give us the address one more time, please.
www.thenhf.com and click on the Government Affairs button.
And oppose Senate Bill 510. Let your legislator know you're against it.
That is correct.
Now, what I'd like to do now, I'd like for you to run down all the reasons why you believe that this bill is extremely dangerous, what it could lead to as far as genetic engineering and the manipulation of crops, and therefore the opposition, which is already strong in Europe, very strong in Europe, but how we have to be more aware of the lies of the genetic engineering scientists. We have to be aware of the power that they have with Michael Taylor, formerly of Monsanto, that was hand-selected by Barack Obama. That tells you as much about Barack Obama. He has virtually handpicked every single one of these corporatists and these elite multinationalists. He has not selected a single populist, a single progressive, a single independent person in his entire administration. How is that humanly possible? And yet he has managed to do that. So I want people to realize how dangerous this bill is. The form is yours. Take your time. Go through each thing, why you're opposed to it.
The other main reason we are opposed to it is because it imposes burdensome record-keeping requirements on food businesses that are really unnecessary. But what happens is the burden of all these record-keeping requirements fall most heavily on small and medium-sized farms and ranchers, farmers, ranchers, orchards, and the like. The big agribusiness, the ones that use the GM food crops, they aren't going to care. They can hire an extra accountant if they need to, an extra bean keeper, an extra clerk or the other to deal with the record-keeping requirements. That's no skin off their nose. But for a small company, for a medium-sized company even, these add thousands of dollars of costs, plus the filing fees, plus if there are reinspection fees and the like. And in our opinion, in NHF's opinion, this is meant to drive out the small businesses. And when you do, those are precisely the ones that aren't using the GM food crops. It's the big agribusiness that doesn't mind using and planting and reaping and harvesting the GM food crops and then selling them throughout the world. So what it's doing is this bill will drive eventually, not tomorrow, not even the next day, but it will sooner rather than later drive out most, if not all, of the small businesses that we depend on for good, healthy food, leaving us only with the GM food crops and no choice whatsoever. So this is problem number one with this bill. And the other is the arbitrary abusive power that it puts in the hands of the FDA. That's number two. And then the other thing is, quite honestly, is that it has a, in this sense, there is a undue power put in the hands of the Secretary of Health and Human Welfare, because of the ability, based on what I was saying earlier about a reasonable belief, to remove a product from the market if the secretary thinks it will have a harmful effect upon health. And this is too much power to put in the hands of one person. But regardless, the whole structure of it is unnecessary because, again, this is something that should be put, that should be dealt with at a local level, at the municipality level, at the state level, and that's the way it was intended. The only reason it's gotten to this point is that where there's been a little bit of a cry for this, usually most of this is coming from the agribusiness, this cry for this bill, but it's because agribusiness, you know, has been doing these kind of food practices that are quite unhealthy, where they drug the animals, where they give them all sorts of antibiotics, where they then overcrowd the feedlots, and this produces all sorts of waste products that then get into the nearby streams and rivers and then contaminate the smaller farms downstream. And then when you come up with the salmonella problem, it's not because we need a big monstrosity bill like this and a bigger, more powerful federal government to deal with it. We just need the enforcement of the existing local and state health laws that are there to protect us in the first place. That's all we need. We don't need to create yet another layer of bureaucracy that's going to put 1,600 new FDA agents in the field to harass us like George III's servants did before the Revolutionary War and that led to the Revolutionary War. What we're going to have is a horde of these bureaucrats fanning out throughout the country to cause problem and to wreak havoc and basically to be the agents of the big corporate agribusiness and to promote either directly or indirectly, intentionally or unintentionally, the GM food crops that your listeners and you and I don't want.
Well, I see a contradiction here, Scott, and we're running out of time, and we have Animal Magnet, Pet Radio, and Deb Wolf on in a moment. But she's so interested in the show, she just sent to our engineer, she said, continue with this thought for a few more moments. Fine, thank you, Deb, we will. I see a contradiction, and herein is the contradiction. On the one hand, historically, the conservatives and Republicans, not that they're always one and the same, they're frequently not, have wanted smaller government. But the Republicans have wanted larger government when it comes to the military-industrial complex, the hospital associations, the insurance industries, the pharmaceutical industries, the nuclear, coal, gas, and oil industries, and the prisons, all of which they wanted more of. Therefore, they stated publicly, we're for smaller government. But in all cases, they wanted larger because the subsidies that the taxpayers paid had nothing to do with laissez-faire. In other words, they couldn't lose. If they made money, profits on the upside, they kept it all. If they lost, then they got subsidies to the tunes of tens to hundreds of billions of dollars on an annual basis. So they were absolutely hypocritical, and all you have to do is look carefully. On the other side, many conservatives said, and bring in the libertarians who said, I want government that's effective. If that means a government that has mandates, then let me have the mandate for a government that actually serves the needs of the people. Because what is the purpose of any government, state, federal, local, except to serve legitimate needs of the people? And for that, you need certain regulations that protect us. And one of the things that the Republicans did, they got rid of all the laws that interfered in them exploiting a very vulnerable public, and hence the Glass-Steagall Act. They changed the commodity future trading laws, and therefore they were able to gamble in commodities essential life, whether it was oil or gas or food or water, and privatize it. So all you have to do is simply step back and say the media that supports the Republicans, the talking heads, including my commentary mentioning that these are the neocons, the people that love war because they profit from it. Not that they want to see people killed or blood or suffering. I don't think that I don't think that's in their agenda at all. But that's the unintended consequences. On the other hand, you have the Democrats and liberals, not always the same, who said, but we want to see stronger government, larger government, because look back at FDR and look back at Lyndon Johnson. Well, look back at him. Do you think we got out of the Great Depression because of FDR's great policies? No,
of course not.
We didn't. In fact, the greatest expenditures and the most public hiring in the public sector was also when we had one of the largest double-dip downs in the Great Depression, 1933 and again in 1936. It was the small entrepreneur that pulled us out in World War II and gearing up for that. But today, we have approximately 6 million small business people. We have approximately 122 million people working in the private sector. We have approximately 26 million people working in state, federal, 22 million people working in state, federal, and local government. And on the one hand, the largest entitlements and the most protection and always the greatest increases go to those that are in the public, the government sector, and the ones that are getting hammered and their quality of life reduced go in the private sector. And it's interesting because those who claim, let's take back America, let's gain back the family values, who in the hell do you think undermine the family values? It had nothing to do with homosexuality. It had nothing to do with pornography. It had nothing to do with the sexual revolution. It had everything to do with since 1980, when you had approximately no more than 10 to 11% of the wealth handled by the smallest group. Today it's well up over 30%. You had disproportionate amount of wealth. So on the one hand, you have people saying, we're liberal, we're for the people. And I say, no, you're not. Look at Democracy Now! Amy Goodman and promoting this stupid bill. And look at them promoting the AIDS. You know, AIDS, any drug is fine with us. You know, take all the drugs you want. You know, more money for AIDS drugs. Never once looking at the fact that it's all fraud. Never once looking for the truth. Never once looking at the erosion of our freedom of choice. No, never once looking at bloated, gigantic bureaucracies that serve no purpose other than every year you get them bigger, you want more money, it just goes into a black hole with no accountability. So on the one hand, you have conservative, you have Republicans that have bankrupted us. You have Democrats that have bankrupted us. They're both the same, Bill Clinton and the rest and Barack Obama. You have some conservatives who want more responsible government and family values, but never once challenge the Republicans, who are the policymakers, who say that they are conservative because of abortion rights and because of government restrictions, when indeed they're not one and the same. And now from this, you have morphed an independent group of people who say, shame on both of you. Shame on you for allowing massive over-regulation, massive bureaucracies, massive spending, massive waste, massive wars, massive destruction of our environment, massive manipulation of our food supply, massive diseases that are actually caused by the very policies that are promoted on the media by Fox and others, by selling kids sugar-coated cereals and French fries and all the other crap, and massive medicalization and pathologizing by these massive bureaucracies and nurses and doctors in the hospitals. And now you've got this enormous group of people who are not organized, not cooperating, but they represent 42%. And from those, about half are now calling themselves progressive and trying to see the truth of how to go from here to there. So that's why I'm opposed to all this, because none of it is going to help make us a better world, make us have healthier and more abundant food. Nothing is going to prevent a reverse disease. Nothing is going to make us feel more comfortable in the lives we're living as far as the safety of the life we're living. And yet it's all done in the name of public safety. And it's supported by both the Democrats and Republicans, by the liberals and the conservatives. And it is only the independents who are progressive enough to see the carnage wrought by this who are standing up to it. Those are my thoughts, your closing thoughts, and then we'll go over to Deb Wolf, who is sitting by and just emailed that she appreciates these thoughts.
Thank you, Gary. I think you and what you said just now are speaking a very fundamental set of truths, and that's the problem that we face these days, and that is that we cannot trust the Republican leadership. We cannot trust the Democrat leadership. They're just two arms of the same corrupt system that we've had to deal with. And we're looking at a system, too, where people who are not conservatives are calling themselves conservatives. Of course, now they call them neocons, but these are not conservatives. These are washed over, rehashed liberals, basically, in the same way that the socialists took over the liberal label, which it used to mean something completely different in the 19th century leading into the 20th century. Those were people who were in favor of a free market, individual liberty, free trade, and the like. Now it means the complete opposite, government control over individuals' lives from cradle to grave and the like. They've captured that label. Now they're starting to do it with conservatives, too. They call themselves conservatives, like George Bush was a, quote, conservative. He wasn't. He was a neocon. So they're trying to fool the people by capturing the labels, and we need to be very aware of that.
And now and the you're absolutely right. Scott, we're out of time. Thank you very much for coming on. And once again, you have to pull back far enough from a particular bill and its consequences to connect the dots to see how both the Democrats and Republicans in power and in the media both on the left and the right, support the wrong legislation. They've supported a failed war on AIDS, war on cancer, war on heart disease, wars on mental illness. They support the drugging of our children. They support the drugging of our senior citizens. They have given us a fraudulent health care bill, a fraudulent and completely worthless financial reform bill. These are the people we can no longer trust because they betrayed us. And I'm talking also about the people who lead on the left in the media and lead on the right in the media. So thank goodness that there are enough independent people now that we're speaking out. Scott Tipps, by the way, a little background on him. He is one of the leading fighters on Codex Alimentarius, which is helping protect our freedoms of choice. He graduated magna cum laude from UCLA and studied at the Sorbonne in Paris and received his Juris Doctorate from the University of California, Berkeley Law School. All the best to you and your efforts, Scott.
Thank you, Gary, and the same to you, and appreciate being on your program. Thank you.
Okay, we will now go back to Deb Wolf. I wouldn't have gone into Deb Wolf's time, but I appreciate the extra little time we have, and I'll be back at 3 o'clock with another program.
The Gary Knoll Show is produced in our New York City studios. The producer is Richard Gale. The engineer is Matt Bogart. All shows are archived by Joe Kemp. Our chief archivist is Sharon Pride, and the program director is Carol Lee.